Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, January 27th. Hawaii clinches a federal designation as the first statewide economic development district. What does that mean in these uncertain times and the threat of federal cuts? For more than a decade and a half, a moving picture archive has been working to preserve our history for a matter of record. Now it's being held out as a model for other states. Researchers dive into the use of aquatic fungi to fight against plastic pollution in the ocean, breaking down what's ending up in the sea and in our food chain. And the uncertainty around TikTok's future and a new owner has content producers hopeful, but still worried. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. For the first time, the U.S. Commerce Department has given an economic district designation to a whole state, and that state is Hawaii. Mary Alice Evans is the director of the Hawaii Office of Planning and Sustainable Development. We recently talked to her and Lauren Permiano, manager of strategic initiatives, about what impacts the designation could have on federal funding for local projects.
So Congress established economic development districts several decades ago, and Hawaii did not apply for that until we realized that other states with development districts were getting more economic development funding to improve and diversify their economy. And at that point, we looked at our own economy, and we said the whole state is a interwoven economy where Honolulu is the major city and the hub. The neighbor islands are nodes, and they interact with Honolulu. So what we decided was it made no sense to go in for, say, 4-county economic development districts. The only logical thing was to go in as the whole state. And then we learned that no other state had done that and that we were a pioneer in this. But we got lots of encouragement from the Economic Development Administration, which is a federal program under the U.S. Department of Commerce. So with lots of support, and working with our county offices of economic development, and all 4 counties have an economic development board. Those are private nonprofits that support and promote economic improvements and diversification in their counties.
And Lauren, I don't know if you want to speak to, you know, the fact that there is some hand-wringing about what kinds of cuts Hawaii might see under a new administration, but how do you think this might help?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you're asking about any to read the tea leaves in terms of the new administration. And if so, it really is too soon to tell. But I will say that Congress very recently reauthorized the Economic Development Administration with overwhelming bipartisan support and a very strong vote of confidence from both the House and Senate. So this was signed into law, and this reauthorization was basically Congress's stamp of approval on the work that the EDA was doing and essentially codified it, as well as expanded and increased the appropriations for the EDA's program. So, you know, all this to say, you know, we are cautiously optimistic that based on this reauthorization, based on bipartisan support in Congress, that the EDA will continue to receive support and be able to then in turn support the states and the economic development districts, including ours.
Mary Alice, I mean, we are a canoe state, right? We're the only state comprised of islands and different counties. We are unique in that regard. And I think just with, you know, the disasters that we've seen, whether it's COVID or the wildfires or the lava inundation, I mean, we certainly have some unusual circumstances that really are tied to our economy. So we're in a fragile state in that regard.
You're absolutely right. And the bright light there is that we all help out when there's a disaster and it has this huge economic impact. Still working with Maui County as the lead on how their economy can recover. And it wasn't just Lahaina, the whole Maui island economy has had some serious challenges due to the wildfire. So that's the kind of thing that an economic development district can help with. There are, in addition to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's help, most people know it as FEMA, that came in and did so much for Lahaina survivors and Maui County. The Economic Development Administration also, as part of an all-federal family effort, joined in and has provided with support on how to characterize the Maui's economy, the economic impacts, and the roadway to recovery. So it's just part of an Ohana Kako effort that we're really pleased to be a part of. The leader of this Economic Development District Governing Board will be our Department Director, Jimmy Tokioka. He has a lot of experience with Hawaii's economy, and that will, I think, make this a very successful effort right from the get-go.
And Lauren, talk about the approach that you took when you put this application together.
You know, it's a lot of what Mary Alice was talking about in terms of that partnership, and we're really fortunate to have such a great partnership and working relationships with not only the county economic development offices, but those private economic development boards who all supported and advocated for this designation and worked with their respective leadership and county councils to enter into a partnership agreement that these organizational foundations for the economic development district. This, of course, strongly supported by Governor Green as well as Director Tokioka, as Mary Alice mentioned. But we were also very fortunate to have a great support system within the EDA from our, the most local level, having the economic development representative for the EDA, Keoki Noji, as a major champion for this initiative and for our communities, all the way up to the leadership at the EDA's Seattle Regional Office, and all the way up to the Assistant Secretary of Commerce. And, all of them really helped to shepherd us through this designation process. And I would be remiss if I didn't, of course, also acknowledge our congressional delegation. All four members and their staff really helped to get this across the finish line. So, this was a monumental effort. It was really a testament to all levels of government coming together to make the designation possible. And we just think that sets a great tone for the work ahead.
So what types of projects do you think we'll apply for?
So the EDA has a number of programs, but their primary programs are a public works program, which is funding for construction projects, as well as an economic adjustment assistance program. And those are typically non-construction, more programmatic types of grants. So think about things like workforce development, entrepreneurial support types of programs. And historically, projects and programs within our state have been beneficiaries of these funds. Just to give a couple of examples, the Aquaculture and Ocean Tech Incubator, which was a construction project at the Natural Energy Laboratory Authority of Hawaii over on Kona, that was a recipient of funding. The University of Hawaii received some funding to support their various entrepreneurial support programs. Over on Oahu, the Foreign Trade Zone Homer Maxi Incubator Center was supported by EDA funds. So it's really a breadth of economic development facilities, infrastructure, job development and support programs, entrepreneurial programs, and general economic diversification initiatives. So we're really excited that this designation is going to open up the doors for more parts of our island that may not have been eligible previously to now be eligible for these funding.
So Mary Alice, this really does give us more oomph, I guess. If we want to develop more, let's say around agro-business, agroforestry, because food mm-hmm. security is obviously a big thing, with our island state.
Yeah, food security requires food processing facilities now with the Food Safety Initiative. So this will give us some funding to help support some of those facilities that individual farmers can't afford to do but need to be able to market their products. Another great example of EDA funds at work here in Hawaii has been the Waianae Comprehensive Health Center. They have gotten funding over the past years to build new facilities in their campus, and that supports, the whole Waianae coast, the whole west side, for immediate health care, and also for the supportive health care for chronic disease management. So Bay Clinic over in Hilo also was able to build a new clinic with EDA support. So lots of opportunities. Those, by the way, also support well-paying jobs. There's the areas where local folks can start out at a fairly beginning level and then work up to some very well-paid jobs.
Workforce development, very key to our economy.
You know, in addition to the benefits that we discussed about this designation, opening up doors for more projects like the ones that we described to receive funding, you know, we really are excited that as a part of the designation, the state is establishing wraparound services, if you want to think about it that way, to assist organizations with accessing these funds and putting them to work. You know, we really think this is especially valuable for those smaller community-based organizations or nonprofits that maybe haven't pursued federal funding in the past because it's just so complicated and time-consuming to manage. So, you know, it's both about unlocking access to federal funds as well as building capacity within our communities to draw down and maximize those funds. We're really excited about both of those things.
That was Mary Alice Evans, head of the State Office of Planning and Sustainable Development Office, and Lauren Permiano, manager for strategic initiatives, talking about the significance of Hawaii gaining a designation as a statewide economic development district. It remains to be seen what kinds of gains Hawaii may see in getting access to additional federal money in a time when President Trump is looking to cut spending.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend, HPR presents Kilia. This concert is part of HPR's Mele Hawaii Performance Series. Kilia is performing this Saturday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
In a time of disinformation, it is more important than ever to have a place of record. The archives of KHON, KITV, KGMB, and now Public TV, PBS Hawaii, stretching over many decades, are being preserved at the University of Hawaii West Oahu campus. For the last decade and a half, the state's archive for moving images has developed into a resource and hub for the community. We recently had the chance to talk to head archivist Janelle Curanti and collection specialist and producer Heather Juni. They are passionate protectors of our history, our collective stories in Hawaiʻinae, and their work is being recognized as a model for the country. Juni starts us off by reflecting on the origins of ʻUluʻulu, which is the official state archive for moving images. ʻUluʻulu means collections, assembly, or gathering, and as a resource, it brings us together to learn about our past.
This facility was built by community. Community got together many times in different groups, in different phases over the years, over the decades, to try to create something that would save our moving image history. If you can imagine, there was no place here in Hawaii that had a facility that could take care of films and videos. And finally, in the 2000s, when digitization became commonplace as a word, or certainly a new word that everybody was moving toward, we were able to pick up some speed and went to Congress with the help of Senator Inouye and his staff, supported us with the congressional directive that gave us seed money to develop this opportunity. And we went to community and we asked community what they wanted and needed and expected it. And with the support of our community that was in museums, archives, artists, variety of all kinds of people in backgrounds. We basically hired a consultant who put together a plan for us, and fast forward, here we are today. And during that journey, with the assistance of Chris Lee, he took Ulu'ulu under his wing as the head of Academy for Creative Media and helped forge a path for space in the University of Hawaii at West Oahu. So we're really excited that we're there. We have wonderful space there that we're able to share all kinds of things.
It's a fabulous facility, and if people have not been out there, and, you know, Janelle, you're there really pushing every day to not only just digitize the collections that you have, but also to push the envelope, right? And I hear that you folks are offering classes now for archival studies?
Yeah. So Ulu'ulu, you know, we just celebrated our 15th anniversary last year. So it's been really exciting both to look back on our beginnings, like Heather was describing, and also seeing where we are right now and all of the exciting things that are coming up in the future. And one of those exciting things that we've been able to do is to teach new professionals who are interested in learning about moving image archives, how to do media preservation, and how to apply and gain hands-on experience in actually working with archival media. Because, you know, analog tapes, analog film reels, nobody has those anymore in their homes. And so that becomes one of the challenges that Ulu'ulu has to work through, is how do we take care of these analog media reels that are deteriorating, and how do we digitize them so that people can continue to watch the footage that's recorded on them. And so our training happens through internships, through classes that I teach at UH West Oahu for creative media majors, as well as classes that I teach at the University of Hawaii at Manoa through the Library and Information Sciences program about moving image archiving.
Yeah, and, you know, Heather, I know you and I both have our roots in television news. And to see that recorded history saved because you have the libraries of KGMB, KITV, and KHON stored there, right?
We do. And I have to say, thanks to you, KITV's collection is with us. And we do. And it's a great primary educational resource. People use it all the time.
You are also now rebooting your website, and people will have access to a lot of this material?
Yes. And so one of the exciting things that we were able to launch just last year was a brand new website as well as a brand new online catalog. And when people go online to westoahu.uluulu.hawaii.edu, that is their main public access point where they can search our catalog, watch clips of the footage that we have in our collections, interact with the archive and interact with the collections, and connect with us if they need help in finding other footage or if they are interested in getting copies or using the footage for a new program.
What I love about Ulu'ulu is that you really are the keepers of our history, the news events for the last, I don't know how many decades. And the idea was that you said, let's preserve it, and then we'll figure out how we're going to digitize this stuff. And, you know, you've written for grants and you've been able to make some of that happen. But I remember the last time I was there at the UH campus, I think you had gotten a collection of cameras.
Well, we do have a modest exhibit, and that exhibit is based on equipment that people donate to us. And George Tahara's collection came with a lot of equipment. And I think that, Janelle, you can speak to that about George.
So we received the collection from George Tahara, who is a very prolific filmmaker, legendary filmmaker here in Hawaii. And when his collection came to Ulu'ulu after George Tahara passed away, this was in 2019 when we received it, it was 19 pallets of material, which makes sense. His career was so long and, you know, so many years that he was active as a filmmaker. And so these 19 pallets contained hundreds of film reels, hundreds of videotapes, as well as the equipment, edit equipment and camera equipment that he used to make his films. And so part of the work at Ulu'ulu, we were primarily focused on preserving the film and video materials. And secondarily, we also are trying to preserve some of the equipment that he used to try to tell the full story of how George Tejada's filmmaking career progressed and how the materials in our collection came to be created. And in our public space at Ulu'ulu in the library at UH West Oahu, we do have a small exhibit area that we can showcase some of these equipment and help tell the story to students and other visitors to our public space about those collections.
Yeah, I mean, when I just think of all the equipment that we've used over the years just in news, right? We've gone from, you know, three-quarter to beta, and now it's all, you know, SD card. But those pieces of equipment, those recorders that don't exist anymore, right? You scrounge around on the internet looking for, oh, who's got a three-quarter machine that I can use? I mean, that's just a challenge when you see how technology has changed things.
It has changed a lot. But I just wanted to point out that Hawaii's history in moving images is very long. It started here in the early, just 1900s, and it continues and it has grown. And director producers like George Tejada, I mean, there's so many local people, homegrown people here that created a career that are unknown to a greater population here in Hawaii. And so hopefully these people will see the light of day again when people do research on them or make documentaries on them.
And the fact that we've created this digital archive here and now it's being used as a model in other places. I don't know, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So we've been very grateful and very proud that Ulu'ulu has partnered with an organization called BayVac Media out of San Francisco. And BayVac is conducting a study across the country, starting with a survey to find out information about archives across the United States who care for audiovisual material. Ulu'ulu participated in that survey. And because of that participation, we were invited to be one of their case studies for their final report. This is a federally funded project that they're working on. And so Ulu'ulu is one of three archives in the country that was selected for a site visit and to be written up as a model program for audiovisual archives of our size. And so that report hasn't come out yet. The site visit happened in November. And so we should be seeing some of that report coming out in the next few months.
Okay, so it'd be a nice little spotlight on the work that we've done here and what you have a hand in creating. When you sit back and you look at some of these lasting projects and the impact that it's had on our community, that must make you feel good at night when you go to bed. You know, I don't know, Heather. Talk about
Catherine.
That.
Of course, you know, I love our storytelling community. I'm honored to have been a part of it. I love being at my role at KGMB News. Those were fun years that taught me a lot about telling stories. And I worked alongside some really fabulous people. And so breaking away from that and doing independent work, working with independent people like Eddie Murnikamai, Victoria Keith, Puhi Pau and Joan, I mean, the list goes on. And then all of us talking about who's going to archive this. And at the time, who knew it was going to be such important work that we were preserving? And I look back and I'm so grateful for that. And grateful, one of the unique things about Ulu'ulu is that we have raw material. So it's not just a finished program, but it's also the raw material that was kept and that can really tell the story.
Right. You've got the Victoria Keith collection and all the things that she shot. So you've got the raw, the B-roll. You've got it all.
Yeah. I'd like to think we have it all, but so yeah, so our challenge, I guess if you call it a challenge, it's also exciting, is that, you know, we have 70,000 media items in the archive and we're looking to get it all digitized as fast as possible so that the boomer generation can step in and identify a lot of it.
It's a very complicated and complex process to capture a digital file and a digital video from an analog reel, with lots of challenges along the way. The first being the machines that play back these media items don't exist anymore, or they're broken, or we can't find them, all the way up to managing the digital files in a digital preservation platform to make sure that the files last long into the future so that people can continue to watch the footage. So I say that, but it's also so rewarding to be able to go through all of that work and watch the final product, you know, the file that comes back. Usually it's footage that nobody has seen in 40 years, in 50 years. Some of the home movies that we've digitized recently come from families who hadn't seen it, you know, since they were children. And so seeing it now as adults, it brings up so many memories that they've forgot, you know, from childhood. And being able to share that after all of the hard work that we put into it at the archive to get it digitized in the first place, that's, for me, is the most rewarding part of my work.
So do you have any advice to listeners out there who may have some old videotapes or film, who want to know, oh, what do I do with this stuff?
Yeah, our website, again, is a great place to find resources about moving image archives. Our website is westoahu.uluulu.hawaii.edu, and it has contact information where people who may have their own collections at home can contact us and find out more about potentially donating their collections to the archive. Or if they just want some tips on how to care for it in their own homes, we're happy to help with that as well.
And then, like, what amount of federal funding do you folks get, or state funding? I mean, I don't know. Where are you at with that?
Well, I don't know. It depends on the budget that's going through the Congress right now. But mostly we take care of our collections through grants, and philanthropic support.
Okay. Is there anything that you've got through the ledge at all this session? Anything that affects you?
We're working on that.
All right. Anything else? Do you want to emphasize that we haven't really covered? Any other final thoughts?
In talking about grants, I did want to mention that we're currently finishing up a grant that we received from the National Endowment for the Humanities. This was a 3-year grant to digitize close to 1,000 film and video reels related to Hawaii statehood and the effect of Hawaii statehood on the Native Hawaiian and the Japanese American community here in Hawaii. So we're just finishing that this year, have already been able to describe and put videos online that were digitized as part of this project, oral histories from veterans from the 442, veterans from the 100th Battalion, footage from Heather's collection related to the documentary about Senator Inouye, footage from the Hawaii Congressional Media collection that we have, among others. So we're still adding more. And so that's been the latest footage that we've been able to put up on our website.
But the other digitization project near completion is PBS.
We're also part of this really, really great collaborative project that is spearheaded by WGBH in Boston and the Library of Congress. And it's called the American Archive of Public Broadcasting. And their goal is to be able to digitize as much media from across different public stations across the country to be part of a digital collection online that people can access through WGBH's website, as well as being preserved at the Library of Congress.
That was Janelle Carante and Heather Juni of the Uluulu Archive at West Oahu. The files on the PBS Hawaii project will also be available on the West Oahu website later this year.
Support for HPR comes from Honolulu Waldorf School, announcing a middle school open house this Wednesday, 2:45 to 4:45 p.m. Registration at honoluluwaldorf.org.
You are invited to HPR Generation Listens Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to 6 public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawaii.
Today's backyard quiz shines a spotlight on a famous American artist known for her evocative paintings of nature. Georgia O'Keeffe was commissioned to come to Hawaii in 1939 and paint for 3 months. It took her 9 days to travel from New York to Honolulu, and she spent the next weeks touring Kauai, Maui, and the island of Hawaii. In her writings about the trip, O'Keeffe described eating poke for the first time and donning a pair of slippers. But the visit wasn't free of tension. According to one art historian, O'Keeffe was entranced by the beauty of the islands. But the strain of working to a company's specifications created tensions and discord. Upon her departure, O'Keeffe submitted paintings to her benefactors, including one of a lobster claw heliconia and another of Eo Valley. But to the surprise and alarm of the company, not a single one of her paintings featured the subject matter that they had commissioned her to paint. For today's quiz, we want to know, what was Georgia O'Keeffe supposed to paint when she visited Hawaii? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NareitHawaii.com.
What to do about our pesky plastic problem? Well, new research shows that the aquatic habitat growing the fastest around the world is actually plastic. So researchers are looking for all kinds of help when it comes to eliminating plastic in our oceans. Now a team from the University of Hawaii at Manoa thinks the answer might lie with fungi. Rania Steinbach is a marine scientist who led research into the abilities of Oahu's fungi to degrade plastic. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the work.
A lot of people think about bacteria when they think of an organism, a microorganism that can degrade plastic. And in general, there's a huge focus on bacteria in a lot of studies. And fungi are a lot of times the forgotten organism that has huge potential in bioremediation efforts. I chose to go to the University of Hawaii at Manoa in large part because I saw the research that Dr. Anthony Amend was doing, and he was my advisor throughout all of this project. And I was really excited about working with fungi after having learned more about how important they are in our ecosystems. And the inspiration for this particular project came from a desire to figure out how to do something that would really have a larger impact. And there's a couple other studies that have started delving into the world of, I guess, aquatic fungi. That's where this one was kind of adapted from, was one looking at some fungi in lakes. But there still wasn't a big focus on marine fungi, and that's a lot of the research that was going on in that lab. And given the fact that marine fungi are in contact with plastics a lot because of this huge issue of plastic pollution in the ocean, there was this hypothesis that the marine fungi will likely have a higher success rate of being able to utilize this plastic basically as a food source and thus be able to degrade plastic.
So how did you collect some of these samples and then test them to see if they actually were able to degrade plastic?
So the collection of the samples was why this kind of became a joint project. A graduate student in the Amen lab was working on getting all of these random samples, be it water samples, sediment samples, floating debris, things like that, around Oahu, and was then doing all of the work to actually characterize it, figure out if we could get it down to species level or if it was a novel species. And so I was using these samples that she had collected, Serena Wittner, and was then doing visual degradation assays. And so by visual degradation assays, I mean that we were basically determining if there was degradation based off of what we were seeing on a petri dish that had a thin coat of polyurethane over it. And this has been done in past studies because as that thin coat of polyurethane is being degraded, it becomes clear instead of being sort of this white translucent color. By seeing that, we were then able to determine kind of this relative rate of degradation, so how quickly we were seeing that entire plate become completely clear. And also then we're able to just say, okay, this fungus, this fungal isolate seems to have this ability to degrade polyurethane, whereas this one, we haven't seen anything really happen on this plate. And the important thing to remember here too is, I mean, polyurethane, based off of the structure, is definitely easier to degrade than some other types of plastic. And this was really just a preliminary study, just to start, you know, metaphorically dipping our toes into the water, figuring out what potential there is in this, you know, super understudied group of organisms. And the rate of degradation, especially for plastic, can be super, super slow. A lot of terrestrial studies were like finding that it was taking months to see really anything happening. And so even though a pretty high percentage of the isolates tested had this ability to degrade polyurethane, in subsequent parts of this study, we really were only focusing on those that showed the fastest rates of degradation, because it just is a pretty slow process.
Did the lab work of it, like going into the lab and checking on these samples and seeing if it had degraded the plastic? Did it feel like watching grass grow at some points?
A little bit, for sure. But it was always kind of this exciting time where also the other people in the lab would always, you know, just slowly kind of come over when they saw me coming in, and like we would all just enjoy getting to see what was going on, because it is just kind of a very exciting thing to see. Yeah, sometimes lab work can be pretty monotonous, but when you start seeing things like plastic degradation, it just gets everyone fired up again about doing science that can really have a big impact.
Thinking about implications, on the face of it, it's notable that you can identify different species of fungi that can degrade plastic. But how could you imagine this might be used one day in helping to degrade plastic on a much larger scale out in the environment?
So this is where it gets really exciting. And I think there's a couple different approaches that could be taken. But I think one of the exciting things that is also going on in the lab is really trying to identify what enzymes are the reason that these fungi have the ability to degrade the plastic that we're looking at. And if you can figure out what enzyme that is, then you can start producing that enzyme or using the fungi to produce the enzyme and being very targeted about degrading plastic in the environment. And that sort of leads also to the next part of the experiment, in which we were looking at conditioning the fungi to degrade plastic faster by doing these serial inoculations. So basically taking a fungus that was growing in 1% polyurethane and then putting it into 5% polyurethane and then into 10%, and seeing if there was this metabolic adaptation that was occurring that was making that fungus now degrade polyurethane at a faster rate. And if you look at the genes and start looking at the DNA of the fungus before it went through doing all these serial inoculations to after it was then faster at degrading plastic, that can then help us identify what enzyme it is and where in that genetic code we can start looking into when it comes to research down the line.
Is there anything else about this study or about marine science more generally that you wish audience members could take away from this interview?
I think that people should just remember the fungi and that the little guys are doing a lot for us. I think we get really focused on the things that we can see and we forget how much is happening, be it under our feet in the soil when it comes to fungi, or again, in the water. I think a lot of people don't even realize that fungi are part of the marine system as well. And realizing that there's really huge potential for these microbes and other small organisms to do really incredible things for us and in general for the ecosystem and, you know, how we are interacting with the ecosystem and making sure that we're creating a sustainable place to live within our interactions with the natural world.
Fascinating. That was marine scientist Rania Steinbach and HPR's Maddie Bender. The fastest fungi got rid of a palm of plastic in just under 3 weeks. We'll have a link to the team's new study on our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30. Here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from Nico's Kailua near Aikahi Shopping Center, serving lunch, pupus, dinner, and handcrafted cocktails. Featuring live entertainment nightly, Tuesday through Sunday, music schedule at nicoskailua.com.
And now it's time to fill in the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a trip to Hawaii made by the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. The Hawaiian Pineapple Company, later known as Dole, commissioned two paintings from her in exchange for a trip to Hawaii. When she arrived in 1939, she was denied a residence near the plantations and was instead given a peeled, sliced pineapple to paint. Undeterred, O'Keeffe set off on a tour of the territory. She produced more than a dozen paintings and sketches of flora and landscapes in her typical abstract style. O'Keeffe also produced two paintings for her benefactors to use as advertisements. But the Hawaiian Pineapple Company wasn't exactly pleased with them, as neither of the paintings featured the subject that they wanted her to depict, which was pineapples. And boy, this question blew up our phone lines, but our winner, Richard from Pearl City, had the fastest fingers. But that's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, it's been a week since access to TikTok was paused and then back on again, as talks are underway to find a possible buyer so the social media platform can continue to operate here in the U.S. HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio covers culture and arts issues and recently talked to content producers across the Pacific. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So what did folks say?
It was a mixed reaction, actually. So when the TikTok ban happened briefly on the 19th, a lot of content creators took to other Instagram platforms, social media platforms on X, saying that, you know, they're frustrated, they lost all their content, and not just the videos they created, but the genuine connections that they made across the Pacific or across the world that they couldn't get elsewhere. But other people have said, you know, life goes on, especially most of the folks I talk to are from the millennial Gen Y generation, where we saw the rise and fall of MySpace, Vine, and even Musical.ly. And so when I put out the call on social media, I got Tamaliva Salanoa. She's Samoan from Alaska, who downloaded the app in 2019. That's when it rose in popularity, the TikTok app. But she really started using it during the pandemic to sell her art for income. And this is when no one was hiring at that time.
I was just getting out of college. Like, I had just graduated. Like, my feet have left the campus and the world was not hiring anyone. So I was looking for an avenue to find some kind of income. And I got my degree in digital art and design. So I was just like, well, I have a degree in art, so maybe I can make some kind of apparel. So I started like when TikTok started to gain more traction, I started using it as a platform to sell before it even had that option. So I was showing the process of how I made my designs. I was showing the process of like how I order, how I like screen printed my designs onto the garments. And I was just bringing people along for the journey. And then before I knew it, 1-2 followers, and then it jumped up all the way to like 9K. And then I was making sales averaging about $6,000 a month, because nobody was able to go to stores to buy things. So everything was just moved to e-commerce. And people really didn't understand that that was happening. I didn't think that was happening, but I just wanted to find some way to make extra money, because the job that I had let me go. And they were just like, they withheld my last portion of my stipend. So I was like really like SOL out of luck, and had to figure out something and pivot quickly in order to find a livable wage from like my family.
That's quite a story.
Yeah. And now that we're post-pandemic, she only uses it as a side hustle. But something that Salanoa said about TikTok is that it brings more authenticity and the algorithm is better. An algorithm in social media are rules and signals and data that govern a social media platform's operation. So that means whatever, the more you like and comment on certain content on your social media app like Instagram, the more you will see on your page. So let's say you like researching Chamorro food, you're going to see a lot of Chamorro food pop up on your page. That's an example. I also spoke with Mara Mahoney, who is from Fiji, and she created her TikTok account in Hawaii. So she thought she was safe from the ban. So she knew the ban was coming. So she tried to fix up her account to make it where she's like, she's back in Fiji. She's based in Fiji, so she won't be affected. But because she created her account in the U.S., she did get that notification that TikTok was inaccessible for her. So, but for her, she created her TikTok also during the pandemic. That's when we saw the rise in popularity for that app. And she uses it to share books from Pacific Islander authors. She would also have conversations about social issues facing the Pacific, like climate change and decolonization. Although she talks about not caring about the content and hours of editing that was lost during TikTok being offline, she cared more about the people she's built a relationship with. But that also made her think about depending too much on the social media app and remembering that she can still make those connections as a Pacific Islander in the context of storytelling and culture.
First, I didn't think it would affect me. I thought that being in Fiji, that I was, you know, I was in a safe place. I was sad, like, for all the other, you know, content creators, Pacific content creators, that I was going to be missing out on their content. But I'd connected with a lot of them on Instagram. And so when I actually tried to log back, like, you know, just did my daily scroll and I couldn't, then I was like, oh my gosh, like, it's happening to me too. And it really made me think about how quickly digital spaces can become, you know, inaccessible. And it was kind of, you know, that moment of disconnect was kind of jarring, because not because I lost my content, because I suddenly couldn't reach the community I'd built over the past year. And I think what's really powerful about TikTok, and what I think people may not understand, is how it's become this incredible space for Pacific people to connect across colonial borders. like I've had conversations with people from around the Pacific about decolonization. We've shared poetry, discussed, you know, like climate activism. And these aren't just casual interactions, you know, they're meaningful conversations that help us understand our shared experiences. I think what really strikes me is how these digital spaces have become modern versions of, you know, traditional Pacific meeting grounds. Just as our ancestors would gather to share stories and knowledge, we're using these platforms to maintain those connections across like these vast differences. And when you think about it, you know, Pacific people have always been experts at long distance communication and community building.
And taking it back to the local level, I spoke with Stacey Alapai, who's a Maui resident who uses her TikTok to share her civic engagement. So she uses TikTok to explain what's happening at the Maui County Council, the Planning Commission, and other government agencies. And she talks about how TikTok differs from other social media apps.
I'm a millennial of the MySpace generation, so I've seen lots of different types of social media come and go. And TikTok seemed really unique to me because I saw people being a lot more authentic and kind of raw. And obviously a lot of those other social media type things of like curating how people see you, that definitely exists there. But something new that I saw was people being more honest and authentic and like not necessarily like all made up faces and pre-recorded stuff. It was a lot of straight from the brain to the internet. And it seemed a lot more like an authentic connection being made between communities online, especially on the like Hawaii creator side of things. And I really enjoyed that as a user.
So there's still some uncertainty over the future of TikTok. Donald Trump signed an executive order the day he took office on a 75-day extension for the social media app to comply with the law, either to just ban it completely or to sell it to another U.S. company, since it's owned by the China-based company ByteDance. But since TikTok briefly went offline, some folks that I've interviewed kind of lost that trust in TikTok already, and they're already gravitating to the next better thing, which is Red Note, another China-owned company.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, this was fascinating. Thank you for bringing these voices to our ears. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, thank you. We have been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio, and she's been reaching out to Pacific content producers about the uncertain future of TikTok. Well, that wraps it up for us for this hour. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from Hawaii Representative Joe Takuta as we check in with Hawaii's delegation to Congress about the transition in our nation's capital. What are your thoughts about the next 4 years? Hopeful? Worried? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.